This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, with the rising popularity of esports and online gaming, we'll find out why UW La Crosse created a video game recreation center for students on campus. Now, the primary election for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court is a week from tomorrow. Voters will be narrowing down the candidates for a hotly contested race, drawing national headlines. It's a really important role in Wisconsin state government, but what do the justices actually do? We know they issue rulings on high-profile cases, but what are they doing the rest of the time? Turns out the justices serve a variety of important administrative and regulatory roles in the state as well. We're going to take a crash course on the state Supreme Court leading up to this big election, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what the state Supreme Court does and does not do? Are there any misconceptions you want cleared up? Have you dealt with the court system going all the way up to the state Supreme Court in one capacity or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He specializes in public law, judicial process, and American politics. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you lay out the basics of the, you know, the constitutional role that that the state Supreme Court is supposed to have?
Well, in very basic sort of elementary school civics kind of approach, yeah, we have three branches of government. And as most of us learn, there are separated powers that are checked. And so we have a legislative branch, which is responsible for drafting laws. We have an executive, which is tasked with implementing or executing those laws. And the role of the courts in its most basic form is we want them to interpret the laws and apply them fairly, hopefully to achieve some sort of justice, as we're going to define that as a society. But as you noted in your introduction, all courts have a role that goes much beyond merely interpreting law because they help to manage our system of justice in myriad ways.
Before we get into the tasks of the Supreme Court, the elections for the Supreme Court, each state does things differently. Some elect, some don't. Some other states, you run as a Democrat or a Republican or whatever. In Wisconsin, it is, at least in theory, nonpartisan. Could you tell us what makes our system of judge selection, I guess not fully unique, but stand out to you?
Well, one of the interesting things to me is if you look at the history of the constitutional development in this state, there was quite a bit of debate about exactly how judges were going to be selected in the state. And up until the ratification of our constitution in the state, there was a movement, rather slow and incremental, to add the election of judges because most eastern states that founded the country were using some sort of appointive process, either through a governor or through a legislature. And there's a great line in one of the debates about our constitution where the argument was we should elect because we should rely on the genius of the people in order to pick the judges, that we were capable of making a decision about who would be competent to sit on the bench, both at the trial level as well as at the appellate level, hearing appeals from the lower courts. We are not unique because we do elect. Every state in the union elects at least at one level of the courts. And boy, there are about as many variations in elections and selection as there are states. But there has been a movement away from election towards what are called merit systems. And merit systems, again, vary widely as well. But the idea is you try to create a list of qualified individuals, and that can be described in a number of ways as well. And from that, the governor may select someone or the legislature may select somebody. And then at some point, you face what's called a retention election, where if you've done a good job, you run by yourself on the ballot. And in sort of some sort of Roman emperor fashion, the public gets to give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the job that you've done.
Let's get into the job itself now. The headlines when there's a high profile case, redistricting, ruling out a challenge to an election result, abortion. Then we see the state Supreme Court cases in the news. Can you talk about the range of things as far as caseload that finds its way to the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, so I think what surprises a lot of people is how few cases wind up at either a state or the federal Supreme Court. It is an incredibly small fraction of the cases that come before courts in the state. So, you know, in a typical year, we'll have almost, 700,000 or so cases run through the court. And remember, a lot of those are rather minor misdemeanor criminal cases, traffic cases, and the like. But the court will routinely only take and decide fewer than 100 cases in a given year. And What's also, I think, surprising to individuals is the greatest number are civil cases, not criminal cases. When we think courts, we almost always get sort of sucked into our reliance on television and mass media to portray courts as the sort of final decision maker in all of these criminal cases. But so much more of the law is resolving civil disputes, things as commonplace as a divorce, but also issues relating to product liability or traffic accidents, those kinds of issues. And those very technical civil cases are often the ones that the court is dealing with most of all, rather than, you know, some of the more prominent cases involving notorious criminal matters.
What is it that makes the state Supreme Court say, yes, we're going to take this case? What are some of the guidelines that they use to say this is something that should be handled at this court, of this highest court in the state?
Well, it's funny because no court really has, no Supreme Court has a real well-defined list of you must take a certain number of cases or types of cases. Most state Supreme Courts and the federal Supreme Court hear the vast majority of their cases through what's called a discretionary docket. Docket's a fancy way of just saying a list of cases. And so they have discretion to pick and choose the cases that they think are important to hear. And for the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin, the standard is really kind of wide open. You know, they look to or look for cases that are going to trigger what they consider their institutional responsibility to try and decide complicated or serious and significant cases. And it takes three of the seven justices to provide an avenue for your case to come to the court. And that might seem, well, geez, that's not even a majority. But part of that is because they want to make sure that public policy needs are met. So they want the threshold a little bit lower to take these kinds of cases. So it's really in many respects up to the whims and wishes of the justices themselves about what they deem to be important at any one time. It could be the political or ideological preference of the justices, what are some significant policy concerns in the state at that moment. It could be that there are several cases in one particular area or dealing with one particular legal question that demand the attention right now. So there are myriad reasons why the justices might take a case or not. It just often depends upon the economic, political, and social milieu of any particular age.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College, looking at the role of Wisconsin's Supreme Court. A seat on that court is open. Primary election day is a week from tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Wisconsin's Supreme Court, what it does, why it does it the way that it does? And when you as a voter are asked to pick a state Supreme Court justice, how do you do it? What do you weigh? What are the factors that go into deciding who you vote for? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charlie, in talking to most of the candidates over the last week or so, some of them point toward the other things that justices do apart from hearing cases. They're sort of the bosses of the court system in general in Wisconsin. Can you talk about that part of the gig?
Sure. I think one of the most important roles they play is in their administrative supervisory role, because the Supreme Court, since they sit atop the court system, they're responsible for helping to guide the legislature through the governor's budget toward proper budgeting of the entire system. And as a result, they are always trying to push for more support for judges, more support for staffing, and a variety of resources that are necessary in the system itself. It's always a struggle in the court system, especially on the criminal side, to get adequate funding, because the public isn't always interested in spending their tax dollars to, as an example, sort of help or aid in the processing of criminal cases, because it doesn't seem necessarily worthy of the expenditure of our tax dollars. So, you know, they have significant input into what the budget request will be, although they don't always receive the appropriations that they really desire. Another thing that they really have to do is look to the long term. I mean, one of the things about courts is they're constantly processing cases, and so everything is immediate. Cases come in, they have to be handled in some way and expeditiously move through the system to a resolution. But they have to think long term about what the court is going to be dealing with in a year, in 5 years, in 20 years. So just as an example, one of the big issues that's facing courts today has to do with elder law. You know, you think about the baby boomers who are retiring, and that has certain pressures on certain elements of our system, like Social Security. But think about all of the care that they're going to need and the possibility of fraud and corruption with individuals who might have their resources stolen. They might get improper care from caretakers. And so we have this sort of pig coming through the python with all these individuals who are going to need special attention from the courts. So the courts really have to look in the long term to these kinds of things.
We're talking to St. Norbert College political science professor Charlie Jacobs about the role of Wisconsin State Supreme Court justices ahead of next week's primary election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you know enough about what the state Supreme Court does to cast a vote in that primary election next week? When you are deciding who to vote for, what do you look toward? Do you try to weigh their judicial philosophy? Do you look at how they might be expected to rule on particular issues, the endorsements that come along the way? Call on with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He's helping us learn more about what the state Supreme Court does as we run closer and closer to the election day in the state Supreme Court primary for an open seat, a pivotal seat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the state Supreme Court? Do you worry about the partisan lean of the court one way or another? How should voters evaluate justices? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Oshkosh. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just calling in to say I think right now anyway, and probably most times, it's a myth about the nonpartisan nature of our judges. I mean, it's almost funny to suggest that being true, because clearly right now I see it all about the abortion issue that's pending. At the state Supreme Court will eventually decide the abortion issue from the dominating Republican legislature, and the conservative ones running will support the 1850 rule law, you could even call it that.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, a lot of people have observed that, yes, they don't run with an R or a D next to their name on the ballot. But Mark says it's a myth that they're nonpartisan. What do you think?
I think there's a lot of evidence that the public agrees with Mark. We are seeing at the national level the legitimacy of the United States Supreme Court slip because they are perceived as wholly partisan on their face in the way in which their decisions are made. And the same kinds of issues are bleeding into state Supreme Court races and local judicial races as well. And in fact, it preceded some, I think, of the lost legitimacy at the national level. If you look at some of the races that preceded this year's, with the exception of one or two in the last 20 years, the amount of money that is poured in from outside actors, those outside of the state of Wisconsin or disconnected from direct participation in the race, the money has just been creeping up and up and up. And it's because the expectation is if the right candidate wins, whichever side you're on, you're going to get the kind of decisions that you want, that there is no unbiased court system. It has always been rife with this kind of partisanship. And, you know, we went to a nonpartisan system in the 1890s, and we did in part because the progressive movement was really worried about the perception of partisanship in elections for courts. But the thing is that by calling it a nonpartisan election doesn't make it a nonpartisan election. To me, one of the most farcical is the state of Ohio, where you run in a primary under a partisan banner, but then miraculously it's a nonpartisan general election, as though you transform like a butterfly or something and all of a sudden don't have any ideological perceptions at all. So I think most of the public understands what's going on here, and they look for cues to help them in making their selection, whether a person is liberal or conservative, and what that might signal in the outcome of races. So Mark, I think, is on the right track. We have lots of data in political science that shows this.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. A lot of times candidates will say or tell me on the show, Charlie, don't vote for a judge because you think they'll give them the outcome you want on a particular policy item that may come before them. easier said than done. Like, how do you pick a judge if you take out the policy outcomes?
Well, it begs a question. What's a good judge? Mm-hmm. And I don't have an answer. I mean, you have to ask, how are we going to measure whether or not the output of a particular judge is appropriate and correct? How are we going to define a just outcome? And in particular, if we're talking about rather arcane legal matters that most of the public doesn't understand, it's hard to understand whether or not the outcome was right, just, correct, or fair. And so that's why the cues are so important. That's why we look for the signals that we look for, because we can, as an individual with our own personal biases, try to determine what we think just outcomes would be. And that often has an ideological or partisan valence. That's the problem with this. I wish it were something else. And you know, I've talked with judges who I think bristle when I tell them about the data that we have, but we have really good long-term longitudinal data that shows us, even though judges will protest and say, I am not ideological, their voting pattern shows it very, very clearly.
Right. We see, I think this in a U.S. Supreme Court nomination proceedings, the argument that I'm a judge who will call balls and strikes. I'm an umpire. You know, I'm not rooting for one team or another in the case. Like, hypothetically, couldn't we have a judge like that?
Well, hypothetically, yes. And quite honestly, your example is a good one because it's Justice Roberts. And while, you know, the data we have about him also shows a slight ideological lilt, I think that there was a certain amount of sincerity in the way he positioned himself, because the way he has tried to use his position as Chief Justice is to narrow the issues, try to answer as little as humanly possible in a decision, so that it did not appear, even though it might be ideological, it didn't look ideological to the casual observer. And I think he has become very frustrated with the court. You can see it in some of the opinions he writes, with the way in which his colleagues on the bench have operated. And we've seen in Wisconsin the same kind of little battles erupt. We take the shift from the most senior justice being the chief justice to the change in about 2015, I think it was, to an elective position. Well, that was an internal partisan battle because the chief justice controls some of the machinations inside the court. So it's really hard for the public, I think, to disconnect from what they're perceiving and trying to determine whether or not that is actually sort of the opposite of this kind of ideological positioning that we see. And it doesn't help when we get national organizations coming in and making all of these radical claims, both about liberals and conservatives who are running for the court, because they are injecting that kind of partisanship in the debate. And it really is a struggle for the public to make what they might perceive as the unbiased choice for an unbiased justice.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political scientist at St. Norbert College, about the role of the state Supreme Court. Charlie, when I talk to candidates for the court, I always ask about their collegiality, which feels in some ways like a dumb question. You'd assume that judges at that level would be able to play nice with each other. And yet, we had an incident in Wisconsin where one judge put his hands on the neck of another judge. Some observers described choking. Others said fleeting contact. I mean, it's not always real pretty in Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
No, and it's not pretty in a lot of courts around the country as well, because when you're talking about a state court, you have a much more homogeneous population. And because of that, also, you often have narrower issues that bring the focus of the public and the court and its justices more narrowly focused. And because of that, I think the stakes seem a lot higher. And I'm not saying that the United States Supreme Court doesn't have the same kind of stakes, but because we have a diffuse population, it affects people in different ways. And collegiality is very important. When you hear about the United States Supreme Court, I think that's one of the things that heartens people, is that someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, who were about as opposite in their ideological positions on the court, would routinely go out for pizza and then go to the opera. You know, that makes you feel comfortable that they are trying very hard to work together. But when you hear these kinds of stories about the court, and part of it has to do with, you have to get reelected, so that you have to continually position yourself on the bench to make sure that the public believes that you're performing in the way you promised you would and said you would when you were running as you're heading up for reelection. So the justices on the Supreme Court are freed from that because they have life tenure. So I think collegiality dissipates when you have to constantly run. And I know it's every 10 years, which is a long period of time, but you still have to run for re-election. You still have to convince the public of your abilities on the bench.
Charlie, I wanted to spend most of this interview not talking about the high-profile headline cases. Just in our last minute and a half or so, what are some of the big decisions you are watching for that this new justice being elected might be weighing in on?
Well, obviously, as Mark noted, there's the abortion decision, which is coming soon, that we're going to have to grapple with, and how Wisconsin is going to react to the Dobbs decision in relation to state cases. I think the other issue is still the issue of elections and the regulation of elections and the Elections Commission and everything surrounding it, because we're still grappling with sort of the fallout from a lot of changes that have happened over the years and the recent elections. So from the beginning of photo ID and that kind of validation you have to have when you go to the polls, and now issues related to drop boxes and counting and methods of balloting. So I think those are high priorities because they are so closely aligned with democratic principles and choice. So I think those are two that we're really going to watch for, sort of generally speaking, over the next couple of years.
Oh, and briefly, Charlie, what do we usually see when it comes to turnout in these statewide Supreme Court elections?
Terrible. The average is about 18%, and it may wander as high as about 25% of eligible voters, because nonpartisan elections, generally speaking, don't draw people to the polls. And we see in these sort of lower profile cases, and they're lower profile because a lot of people don't pay attention to the courts, they do what's called roll off. They might vote for somebody who is local in their community, but then not vote for others. So we've seen turnout as low as about 10 or 12% recently in high court races. So I would expect around 20% here.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He specializes in public law, judicial process, and American politics. He was with us today to give us a primer on the roles and responsibilities of the state Supreme Court as primary election day is just over a week away. Tomorrow in the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, the world of dating has changed a lot over the years with the rising use of online dating apps. Whether you're part of it or you're not, learn about dating these days. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Think back to a prehistoric time when giant creatures walked the earth. And if we were there, we would tremble at the mighty footsteps of the giant penguin. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, research published last week in the Journal of Paleontology describes fossils of a species of giant penguin from New Zealand over 50 million years ago. A little perspective first. Your modern penguin, depending on species, can weigh 2 pounds on up to almost 90 pounds for emperor penguins. 90 pounds is big. But you know what's bigger? 340 pounds. That's the estimated weight of one of the species described in the research. You can line them up as offensive tackles, except they spend most of their time in the water. Here's my movie pitch. In Ireland Park, where the extinct giant penguin species is reintroduced to the Earth, it's Jurassic Park meets the penguin movie. Hollywood producers, give me a call. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a new program in Dunn County offers an alternative to incarceration and a path to treatment for people with substance use disorders. We'll get the details from a member of the program's quick response team. Now, esports and online gaming are growing in popularity, especially among younger people. Many high schools and colleges have esports clubs and teams. There are even some professional outfits in there in the competitive world. But at UW-La Crosse, the school's recreation department built a full esports and gaming area in one of their recreation centers. It's called E-Zone, and they recently opened it up for the public to participate for a fee. Jeff Keenan is the recreational sports director at UW-La Crosse. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Colin Kipper is the student coordinator of the E-Zone Gaming Center at UW-La Crosse. Colin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Colin, walk us into the E-Zone. What do we see? What's going on there?
Yeah, so right when you walk into the space, you'll always be greeted by one of our staff employees. Outside of that, we have 24 high-end gaming PCs, two PlayStation 5s, two Xbox Series X's, two Nintendo Switches, and then two Oculus Quest as well.
Jeff, I understand you came to UW La Crosse a few months after E-Zone opened. Did you expect, as a recreational sports director, you'd have this computer gaming lab venue as part of your deal?
I actually started a few months before it opened, so I was okay. Actually able to be part of the process in opening it up. But yeah, it's something that has been becoming popular in the student unions, recreation spaces on college campuses. So I knew it was going to be, you know, something that could be up and coming that I might be taking on. And when I took the job at UWL, that was one of my first challenges when I took the job, and it's been a whirlwind ever since.
And Colin, what kind of response have you seen and heard from students using the E-Zone?
Oh, it's been huge for our campus. I mean, UWL is very known for being an active campus, but honestly, I think the growth that we've seen in the space was something we honestly probably weren't even expecting right away. Just from the second we opened our doors, it's been huge for a lot of our students on our campus.
Jeff, what do you see as the reason to have a computer gaming outlet as part of the rec sports department in the first place?
Yeah, we basically wanted to have something for everyone. Mm. You know, when you create a recreation department, you know, you want something for everyone. So no matter how you choose to recreate, rec sports has something for you. So whether it's the not traditional things like sports and fitness, or non-traditional activities such as the E-Zone or Outdoor Connection or climbing wall, we really wanted to meet students where they are and provide those gamers, you know, a formal place and a sense for them to find community and sense of belonging. So, you know, we wanted to reduce the financial barrier to participation. So the equipment is really expensive, especially the PCs. And, you know, the equipment, you know, makes a difference in gameplay. So if you're competitive, you want that high-end gaming PC, and we have that for you, you know, in the E-Zone.
And Colin,
to building that community for gamers, you know, getting them out of the dorm rooms into a space where they can be side to side and socialize together.
And Colin, I wanted to ask, what kind of balance have you seen between, you know, super competitive people and people who are just there to, you know, try out a new game?
Yeah, no, there's a pretty big balance in that. So we offer kind of during our intramural season more of the competitive side, so where students can sign up and play against other students on a weekly basis. And then, you know, we kind of have our what you would consider regulars who come in, you know, two, three times a week, come in, relax, play video games with their friends for a couple hours just to kind of de-stress from their week in class.
Talking about the E-Zone Gaming Center at UW La Crosse, Colin Kipper is student coordinator, and Jeff Keenan is the recreational sports director at UW La Crosse. Jeff, you've opened this up now. It was originally for students. Now community members can join the fun. What's going on?
Yeah, so we have memberships, day passes, if you just want to try it out for the day for a few hours. And then we also do reservations for corporate events, birthday parties, things like that. We had an open house a few weeks ago to kind of introduce the space to the community, and it went well. And yeah, we just want to share the space with the community. There's nothing quite like it in the La Crosse area. And similar to our Outdoor Connection program or our climbing wall, where we do have that unique offering, we wanted to provide that service to the La Crosse community and invite them in and check it out and, you know, be that service that the university often is in these towns and cities across Wisconsin.
And Colin, you're the student coordinator of E-Zone. I'm imagining you were at least kind of into computer games before you got into the program. Could you tell us what got you excited about it?
Yeah, so my gaming knowledge has been, honestly, since I was a kid. My parents got me into it, but I was ecstatic when I heard that the university was willing to bring a space like this kind of within to our rec center. I think there was a huge market on our campus for students who maybe aren't as interested in the more traditional sides of recreation and want to be able to use a space like this. I was just beyond happy that campus was willing to kind of listen to some of the student feedback that we had been getting the last few years.
Jeff, I know this is a world, computers themselves, the technology and the games themselves, it changes fast. How do you make sure that the center keeps up with that?
Well, we listen to students. We listen to the content experts, and that's who we found to listen to. You know, students have been a part of this project from the very beginning. They're the ones that brought it to us and said, hey, we should have an esports and gaming space on campus. And we listened. And, you know, in order to continue development in this space, we really need to tap into the wants and needs of the students and, you know, kind of, you know, listen to them. So, you know, I might not be the biggest gamer out there, but, you know, it's Colin and the rest of the staff and folks that come into the E-Zone, they're able to point us in the right direction.
Now, Colin, I'm sure most gamers there are friendly people. There are, you know, there are toxic people who go out there in the online gaming world. How do you keep things friendly at the E-Zone?
Yeah, so I mean, we have a pretty strict policy in the sense of any sort of inappropriate behavior that would occur within the space. So luckily, it's never been an issue since we've been open. But yeah, within our policies and procedures that all of our guests who attend the E-Zone have to sign and kind of read through and understand, that we kind of have a no excuse. We don't allow that kind of allow that within our space. So very lucky that it has not been an issue to this point.
Okay, I got to ask both of you. Jeff, first of all, you said you're not necessarily the biggest computer gamer. That said, if you had to pick a computer game to play, whether it's at E-Zone or not, what would it be?
I like the virtual reality. So that was something that's totally different for me. So when we got those in the mail, you better believe I tried it out. And I've been enjoying, you know, trying that out once in a while.
And Colin, what is your game of choice?
Oh, man, right now I have been playing the new Hogwarts Legacy game. So it's based like 100 years before the Harry Potter movies. It's been a lot of fun.
And Jeff, just very briefly, if somebody else at another campus said, hey, we should steal this idea, how should they get started?
Yeah, they can give us a call. And that's what we did, honestly, when we were developing this space, is we reached out to, you know, programs across the country that have done this before and, you know, searched the World Wide Web. And, you know, we learned from others. So folks can definitely learn from us. And in the higher education space, you know, we are all about sharing information and trying not to reinvent the wheel too much.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Colin, thanks for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Been talking to Jeff Keenan, recreational sports director at UW La Crosse, and Colin Kipper, student coordinator of the E-Zone Gaming Center at UW La Crosse. They're with us today to talk about the popularity of online gaming and why UW La Crosse created this eSports Recreation Center. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about leaving home and finding a new one.
In the mid-1970s, Lisa Chutow and her family had to leave their whole world behind, their farm, their friends, their home. They lived in northwest Laos, and the horrors of war were creeping in, so they started walking and ended up in a refugee camp. In the 1980s, Lisa moved to Eau Claire and raised her family there. She shares that experience in this essay, which is read by her daughter, Yia Lor.
When I walk along the Chippewa River, I'm reminded of another river in a place I once called home. Although thousands of miles away, Guqingdao, I have not forgotten the dirt path I walked to fetch water. I have not forgotten the stream that followed me to the garden. I have not forgotten my Hmong village in Laos. When it happened, I was too young and didn't know what to make of it. What child can piece together the meaning of war? My family lived in Sayanbuli province. We were farmers and knew little about the world outside our village or the war that had begun before I was ever born. One December night in 1974, some relatives came to say they were leaving. The war was coming. They tell you though. Despite this news, my family stayed. We cut trees to prepare for our garden. We burned the land and planted rice. We were farmers after all. Then in April of 1975, many Hmong people came to rest along the road by our house. They carried with them their belongings, and they delivered the same message. We cannot stay. We must go. The war is here. I was 9 at the time. My parents handed me my 2-year-old sister and asked that I carry her while they carry the rest of our belongings. Whatever we could not bring would be left behind. I tried to carry my sister, but could not. My parents handed me some belongings instead, but they were too heavy. Feeling the weight of the world on my shoulders, I cried. I cried because I could not carry my sister. I cried because I could not carry our belongings. And I cried because I could not carry the life I only knew. We left our village with hundreds of other Hmong people and never looked back. The paths in the jungles that we walked had already been paved by the hundreds that came before us. As we carried on, we cried. In October of 1976, we finally crossed the border into Thailand. It was in a refugee camp where I spent the rest of my youth trying to make sense of my past and look to the future. It was also here where I married my husband. One day, he suggested we apply for resettlement. We had an 11-month-old son and decided we would go for our little family. We would go for those who have yet to come. With that decision, we became names and numbers written on a chalkboard, paperwork filed away, a statistic, the aftermath of war, perhaps the forgotten. Then in 1987, we were sponsored by a Catholic diocese and left behind the land we first called home, a place where we played as kids, farmed and fell in love, and witnessed the death of those waiting for freedom. America became my new home, and Wisconsin's snow-covered hills and cornfields replaced the jungles and rice fields of Laos. I have tried to find my Hmong village on a map, but it is not labeled like Eau Claire. The river that ran through it is not drawn with a thin blue line like the Chippewa River. Perhaps my village and its river no longer exist, but Guching Gao. I remember the dirt path I walked to feed our chickens and pigs. I remember the teapot we used to boil water from the stream. Thousands of miles and over 50 years later, Guching Gao.
That was Eau Claire writer Yia Lor reading an essay written by her mother, Lisa Chu Tao, who also lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk with a member of the Menominee Police Department about their new role as a behavioral health officer and the new program in Dunn County that's offering an alternative to incarceration and access to treatment for people with substance use disorders. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Dunn County has announced a new program to reduce crime and help people who have substance use disorders. Called Project Hope, this program brings together government agencies and nonprofits to offer access to treatment and an alternative to incarceration. Project Hope employs a quick response team while also offering locations to dispose of drugs and paraphernalia safely without the threat of arrest. The quick response team includes a behavioral health officer, a paramedic, and a social worker. I talked to one of the quick response team members earlier this afternoon, Officer Aaron Berg, with the Menominee Police Department. Can you describe Project Hope as it works compared to, you know, what people might expect, a traditional method of law enforcement?
Well, Project Hope actually stems back from 2016. So back in 2016, our Dunn County started looking at trends and challenges in our community and the local criminal justice system. One of the major factors was substance abuse, specifically alcohol and methamphetamine. So they started looking at researching evidence-based practices, including a diversion program that we have at the county level. So when we talk about Project Hope, it was an idea that started between the mayor of Menominee and the chief of police. And back in 2020, it was designed to link people who are struggling with substance abuse to treatment. And they broke it into four phases. So the initial phase, phase one, was a development of a youth review team. And basically this is a partnership with our police department and our school district. And what they do is they basically look at kids that are struggling in classes, some minor delinquent behaviors, and then they look to try to connect them with mentoring services and other types of services that they feel that might be beneficial. So that's been running for almost 3 years now. Mm-hmm. And so then phase two was the development of essentially my position. So phase two, with this behavioral health officer that I have, what we do is we are looking to actively outreach to individuals through our basically our records management system and through the fire department, we identify people who are might be struggling. And then I lead a team of individuals from the sheriff's department, our human services, a fire department, and then a case manager from Harbor Place. We try to make contact with them and see if they're ready to connect with treatment. If they are, we'll help them do that. If not, then what we do is we look to see how we can help them out. And if there's any ways we can try to support them until they are ready for treatment. So that's kind of where we're at. We have a couple other initiatives that we're implementing or trying to implement shortly.
So in that initial conversation with someone who's seen at risk, you know, they're likely using a substance like methamphetamine. There's a concern that's going to lead them to other crimes. What is that first conversation like when you were there with the behavioral health officer talking to that person, trying to get them on that different path?
Honestly, it's really unique. I've been in law enforcement for about 28 years, and I've never had these types of conversations with individuals before. So I initially thought I would meet resistance, and I thought that people would be standoffish because I'm a cop. And quite honestly, many people, not everybody, but many people seem open to the idea. They seem to want to seek that help. They want support. They're not sure exactly how to do it, or that they feel that there's going to be a setback or failure. So it's quite unique and refreshing. I've had, like I said, very unique conversations where people openly talk about their use. Whereas before on patrol, I don't think I would have had that.
I would imagine, and I think this is something you thought through before starting this program, I would imagine that if somebody was using, say, methamphetamine, they'd be very reluctant to talk about that use with the police officer. How do you reach out? As you said, some are willing, but how do you reach out and encourage them and make them feel like they can talk about this safely?
Well, a lot of it comes down to listening to where they're at, you know, and accepting them for what they're going through. I think just active listening and kind of recognizing the challenges that they may be experiencing and acknowledging that. I think that's the biggest thing, and not having expectations. It's, you know, success for me is going to be just success for a different person. So I need to let them be the driver.
What kind of services can you and your colleagues connect that person with now that they've opened up and had this conversation with you?
Well, ultimately, our goal is to try and get them to treatment. So in Dunn County, our partner is Arbor Place. So ideally, we're going to try and get them connected with Arbor Place. But if that's not they're not ready for that, then, like I said, we try to figure out where they're at, and meet them there. And so what we try and do is we may try to connect them with housing services. We may try to connect them with the food bank or the shelter. And we may try to connect them with human services. We have a behavioral health clinic, so mental health services. It kind of really depends on the individual and what they're seeking. Sometimes it's trying to link them in with job services.
Now, I know we have other law enforcement officers who listen to the show and local service providers. If people are thinking, hey, we need to try this or try this more in our community, what would you say to them about how to get something like this started?
I guess what I would try to do is I would try to link up with communities that are trying to do this and have some initial conversations. And I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to recognize a couple other communities that are doing this. There's Door County, Marathon County, Sauk County, Superior Police Department, City of Madison are just a few that I can name off the top of my head. And I think analyzing what you have in your community for services, understand what they do, and try to pull that all together. And then when you have conversations, you know, the idea is not to set expectations for them. Like I said, let them be the driver.
Officer Berg, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's Officer Aaron Berg with the Menominee Police Department, one of the behavioral health officers for the new collaborative program in Dunn County called Project Hope. We talked earlier today about Project Hope's mission to offer alternatives to incarceration and access to treatment to people with substance abuse disorders. By the way, join WPR Wednesday night at 7 for live special coverage of the Wisconsin governor's budget address. Governor Tony Evers delivers the biennial budget message from the Wisconsin State Capitol. After the speech, stay with us for analysis with WPR's Sean Johnson and PBS Wisconsin's Frederica Freiberg. It's live special coverage of the governor's budget address. That's Wednesday night here on Wisconsin Public Radio, or stream it online at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, changes in the American economy affect people in very different ways. Find out more with the author of the new book, The Six Facts That Matter, Understanding Inequality in the United States. Plus, big box retail stores are moving in different directions in the current economy. Find out which chains are doing well, who's struggling, and you can tell us how you like to shop. Those conversations and more are coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then several Republican-led states are considering proposals to criminalize or restrict drag performances. We'll talk about what really happens at drag events and how they're rooted in popular performance history that goes back centuries. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.